Rome was not built in a day, and World War II was not won by men.
Rosie, the Riveter, Rosie,
Rosie, Rosie,
working on assembly line.
The 1943 recording of the Four Vagabonds performing Rosie Riveter, the hymn, the pop song hymn to the women factory workers who made the weapons and planes while the men went off to war. She's a legend, a sales pitch, a brand, and now an image co-opted for all kinds of contemporary references to sexuality, androgyny, independence, feminism. Real-life Rosies? Well, there was Rosie Bonavides, manufacturing airplanes in San Diego, Rosalind Walter, working the night shift in New York, or Rose Will Monroe, building B-24 bombs in Ypsilanti, Michigan. It was a madman ad man, though, who came up with the jutting chin, sassy bandana, flexed arm, Rosie. Pittsburgh ad man J. Howard Miller, hired to create posters for the war effort, who inspired a generation of women to get into the workforce.
One day I was downtown, all dressed up in my best clothes, and I went into a storefront that was hiring for defense plant work. And I said I wanted a job in a factory. And they said, well, you don't fit in a factory. And I said, why not? That's where the best money is. I want to work in a factory.
Real life Rosie there, Idalia Johnston, the daughter of Scottish immigrants in Cleveland, Ohio. She got a job at the Ohio Crankshaft Company during the war, a job that helped the war effort, but also helped her be her own person for the first time.
Being independent and knowing that I could think for myself, I didn't need my mom and dad to tell me what to do, I became very self-sufficient. And I came out of my shell. Before that, I had been meek, mild. If somebody said boo, I jumped, you know. So I became a person unto myself, and I loved it.
That voice of Idalia Johnston comes from the NYU Tamament Library, the Real Rosie the Riveter Oral History Project. Sumita Mukhopadhyay is former executive editor of the website Feministing.com and joins us to explore the iconography of Rosie the Riveter. Welcome.
Good to be here.
So you could have a Rosie forearm there, I think. Yeah. What do you think the origin of this image is and how it's been co-opted and used today? Because it's all over the place.
Right. Well, the origin of it and... you know, this is where the controversy comes in, is during World War II, when the kind of men went off to war, they needed women to work, right?
Right.
And they, specifically in factories and, you know, in supporting making some of the weapons for the war as well. So it was definitely part of an kind of the American nationalist project, right, in terms of wanting to inspire women that this was their role and this was their way to be patriotic in the moment. I think since then it's kind of evolved, right? And this is where this has kind of come into controversy, of it becoming synonymous with the woman worker, right, internationally, in a lot of ways. And so that it has kind of become synonymous with women's empowerment or worker rights movements, and, you know, different kind of movements have used the image for different moments to kind of inspire people.
But it's also a symbol of, you know, corporate worker enslavement as much as it is, you know, the images of men on assembly lines in the first part of the 20th century.
Right. And that's where it's, you know, it becomes interesting, because how much of an image or where it comes from, does it matter versus what it means to people, right? And so I think it has become synonymous with kind of contemporary feminism and women's empowerment and the woman worker. But very few people actually know the history of it being part of this kind of nationalist project, right?
It's a cool image.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to admit, where did you first encounter it?
I don't know, when I was really young, you know, but I, you know.
Long after World War II.
Yeah, long after World War II. Yeah. And, you know, my family's not American. Like, they weren't here during World War II.
Exactly.
And so I definitely came to it through, you know, probably punk rock, you know, imagery in the 80s and 90s.
So Beyonce grabs this image.
Yeah.
And what does that do?
Well, Beyonce has kind of shown herself to be really interested in feminism, right?
Right.
She continually, you know, she quotes it in her album, and I think she really is trying to portray herself, and I think she genuinely believes, like, this is her kind of moment to show female empowerment, right? And you've kind of seen that in the evolution of her music as well.
And how does she use Rosie? How do you see her using Rosie?
I think she is trying to kind of reflect herself as the empowered woman of our generation,
mm-hmm.
to a certain extent. I don't know if she's, you know, I don't know Beyonce personally. Like, I don't know if she's self-reflective enough to know that that's kind of a you know, a bold move. but I do think she, you know, I think she does occupy the popular imagination right now and has become synonymous with female independence. And I think that is what she inspires in young women in many ways. So I think it's appropriate to an extent, and I appreciate that she would do it because it is such a symbol that's synonymous with feminism and with women's empowerment. But there's a lot of arguments for why, you know, she's kind of using the image and not really doesn't totally embody empowerment.
Right? But Beyoncé goes directly at this tension between feminist empowerment and the selling of sex. I mean, in many ways,
right,
the ad man in Pittsburgh who came up with Rosie was selling a sexual image as much as he was selling a powerful woman issue image.
Right.
And Beyoncé is right in the middle of all that.
Right. Absolutely.
So and what do you think about that?
I mean, I'm a Beyoncé apologist, so I don't
right.
So I think that she displays sexuality, obviously, you know, and there is both her own empowerment and her comfort with being sexual and kind of owning her own sexuality and really putting out there that she's doing it for herself. And then there's the reality of market forces that, you know, you kind of have to look and behave a certain way to be a mega million-dollar pop star, you know. So I think she's constantly playing with both those tensions, but I think she does it pretty artfully because it's pretty clear in her lyrics and just the way that she even, like, dances or positions herself that she really is kind of has ownership of her sexuality.
So you said that you were a Beyoncé apologist. as a young girl, who was a feminist icon for you?
For
as
me.
You were growing up? Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I grew up in the 80s, so it had to be Madonna, but
okay.
Also Hillary Clinton.
Madonna and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. In terms of pop culture, until I, you know, studied women's studies and read about the, you know, the Dolores Huertas and kind of labor leaders and feminist leaders. So
I think Madonna did a little Rosie the Riveter stuff in her day.
She might have. She might
she
have.
She certainly did some uniforms.
Yes.
Just up in some uniforms, that's for sure.
Yes, she did. She did play with uniforms. I think Madonna is similar in the sense of she also was at that intersection of kind of sexual empowerment and displaying really kind of intense sexual imagery while also positioning herself as a very empowered person.
And androgyny at the same time,
yeah,
too. Sort of a genderless sexuality almost.
Absolutely.
Samita Mukhopadhyay, former executive editor of the website Feministing.com.
This is Fred from Palo Alto, California. My favorite feminist is Greta Christina. She has feminism and free thought without prudish views on eroticism, and she's a fabulous and entertaining writer.
Hi, this is Sina in Richardson. The woman I've always thought of as an amazing person was Amelia Earhart. She knew what she wanted, and she went after it, even when she was told it wasn't possible. And she said, I can do it, and I'm gonna.
Hey, they don't all have to be monster celebrities either.
My name is Donna Pergata, and I'm calling from Providence, Rhode Island. And my feminist icon is my mother. She started her own business when I was 12 in answering service, and she used part of the money to take flying lessons in the 60s. It was unusual for women in their 40s to take flying lessons. My father encouraged her, and in so doing, my sister and I and my brothers always felt that we could do anything we had the passion and resourcefulness to do.
Who's your own personal Beyoncé? Give us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the show, check us out at thetakeaway.org. My grandma Hockenberry could be a Beyoncé of the 1800s. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.